This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. David Halberstam's book, The Best and the Brightest, written 40 years ago, documented the foreign policy failures of the boarding school and Ivy League educated intellectuals and elites who worked in the Kennedy administration. Our guest, Chris Hayes, writes in his new book about a new generation of elites who have moved into positions of power through meritocracy, a system that purports to reward hard work and grit, not genes. His book is Twilight of the Elites, where Hayes argues that meritocracy has created some of the institutional failures we see today and has exacerbated the growing divide between the rich and everyone else. Chris Hayes is editor-at-large at The Nation, host of MSNBC's Up with Chris Hayes, which you can see Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10, and he joins us from the studios of MSNBC. And Chris Hayes, it's been a while. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back, Marty.
And congratulations on your TV show. I have to say, it's kind of a must-watch for me.
Well, that really means a lot. Thank you very much. We work really hard on it, and we have an amazing staff.
You do, and what I appreciate about it is that you don't talk horse race. You have an interesting mix of guests, not the usual suspects, and you actually talk about things.
Yeah, I mean, we found that there's a lot of hunger amongst the audience for genuine conversation on substance, and we've been, I think, all of us delightfully and pleasantly surprised that we've been able to follow our vision, our sort of news and editorial judgment about what we think is important, what's interesting, what's going on in the world, what's momentous and impactful, and have the audience follow in terms of ratings and all that stuff.
You know, I have to say, I took me a couple of tries with your book because I always thought, you know, meritocracy is a better than the system of privilege that we had. And if you work hard, you can be rewarded by the system, and then you help others like yourselves to move into positions of power. You have a different take on meritocracy.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that there's a lot in the ideal of meritocracy to recommend it. And, you know, one need look no further than Barack Obama, a man who, under no other system of elite formation in the history of the Republic, could have risen to be the president with his name, his skin color, his background, right? So the idea that I think we all have an intuitive appreciation for and celebration of that is at core of the meritocracy is the idea that we shouldn't close off entrance to the American elite based on what we now consider morally indefensible restrictions, for instance, race and gender, sexual orientation, geography, where you're born, what religion you believe in, right? All that stuff, the idea that we were going to have an elite that's selected solely from a northern white male Protestant establishment, we all reject now, and I think that's all to the good. What we've replaced it with is this idea that everyone's going to compete on the level playing field. That's the metaphor that is inevitably invoked in this circumstance.
Right.
And that the people who are the smartest and the most driven are going to kind of winnow out, and they'll be the people placed in positions of the most power. And what it turns out is that system doesn't produce, I think, it doesn't live up to its own promise. That is to say, it quickly kind of ossifies into something that restricts access. And it also doesn't produce a caliber of elite that is well-equipped to undertake their public role in the best possible way.
Well, let me pick up something that you write, in fact, about yourself. You went to an elite public high school in New York, Hunter High School. You have to pass tests. You obviously have to be smart, be a good student in order to get into the school. But you use this as a way of shedding light on some of the, I guess, the dark side of meritocracy.
Yeah, I mean, my high school embodied this meritocratic ideal as much as any institution I've ever encountered. And I think as much as any institution almost in the country. I mean, basically, sixth graders from around the city, all five boroughs, kids from the outer boroughs and kids with not much money and kids with a lot of money all line up to take a test. One test on a cold January day when they're 11 years old. And if they get high enough, they get into the school. And if they don't, they don't. And what that means is if you're the granddaughter of Mayor Bloomberg and you don't get a high enough score, you can't get into the school. And there's something remarkable about that, particularly given the way that corruption works in so many other aspects of America in the 21st century. You know, there is equal opportunity and a view of equal opportunity at its most austere. The problem, of course, is that over time, a test prep industry has grown up around the test. So you have already the inequalities of the city in terms of very unequal levels of educational quality, of resources, of social capital that young kids have access to. On top of that, you now have an industry in which parents can pay thousands of dollars to prep their kid for the test. And what we've seen is a decline, a very worrying decline, in the percentage of Black and Latino students admitted into the school, down to 3 and 1% respectively recent years. And that means that in a city that's majority Black and Latino, you have a school that's tending towards admitting a class with not a single Black or Latino student. And all this is happening around a system that is conceived to hew to the meritocratic ideal with admirable fidelity. And yet at the same time, it isn't strong enough to defend against the incursions of inequality that happen outside its walls.
But do you think the graduates of your high school, Hunter High School, entered college or entered the world of work different from the graduates of these elite boarding schools in New England, Groton School, there are other schools as Exeter, that they entered the world with a different set of values?
Yes, I do. I mean, one thing I should say is that elites in any time and place, go back to the Roman Empire or look at the church in the Middle Ages. I mean, you know, there are certain pathologies, dysfunctions that accrue to a culture of people that have disproportionate power. There's the old Lord Acton dictum, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And so in documenting what I think are some of the pathologies or dysfunctions of the current meritocratic elite is not to say that it's better or worse than previous incarnations of elite, just that it's distinct to the kind of culture of elite formation. I think the notion of competition as the natural state of a kind of constant, acquisitive, upward-looking competitiveness is very much inculcated in people that rise through the meritocratic institutions in a way that wasn't always the case in previous methods of elite formation. There's also this idea of a cult of smartness, which I write in the book.
Yes.
The idea that smartness is the signature virtue of someone that makes them stand out as a meritocratic elite, and not just one among many, such as wisdom and compassion and prudence and judgment, right? There's a lot of things that you would want in someone who's going to be undertaking very important decisions. And smartness as the most important and signature virtue above all others, that's another, I think, unique and distinct cultural expectation that gets created among the folks that have migrated through these various meritocratic institutions.
Smartness meaning that I'm actually smarter than anybody and everybody else, or I am smarter than you? That kind
Both.
Of smartness?
I mean, yeah, I think the cult of smartness, which I write about at some length in the book, is it's more than just valuing smartness, because I think we all think that smartness is good.
Yes, I would agree with that.
If given an option between dumb leaders and smart leaders, I think we'd all like smart leaders. It's more specific than that. It's A, that smartness matters above all else, and also that smartness is somehow rankable, that it's an ordinal quality like height, right? Someone who's 6'4 is taller than someone who's 6 feet, who's taller than someone who's 5'6. And that you can say so-and-so is smarter than this person, who is in turn smarter than that person, and kind of line people up in this ranked way about who's the smartest. And what that does is it creates dynamics, I think, and I talk about it in the book, of figures who I identify as possessing destructive intelligence, which is to say, if you have this kind of obvious, manifest, intimidating intelligence and brilliance, people like David Addington, who is the general counsel for Vice President Dick Cheney and pushed some of the most maximalist interpretations of the war on terror in terms of torture and the like, Larry Summers, who is by all accounts just incredibly brilliant guy, but who can also be, from all accounts, a real intellectual bully, and that quality is very much valued in the culture of meritocratic achievement, and it creates the conditions under which people who possess this kind of intelligence can wreak havoc because other compensatory values, like I said, wisdom and prudence and judgment, aren't valued as much.
Well, I began by just doing a very tiny synopsis of David Halberstam's book, The Best and the Brightest, and these were the graduates that went to Groton and to Harvard and then into government and got us into the Vietnam War, probably thought they were smarter than anybody else, there were destructive effects from their arrogance about their own smartness.
It's absolutely true, and in many ways, Twilight of the Elites is you know, owes a great debt to the Best of the Brightest thesis, and to other books that have come before about elite culture. You know, one of the things you see in Best of the Brightest is not just that this arrogance, which I think is something that there's a through line to, but also the smallness of that world. And one of the ideas behind the meritocracy and the social movements of liberation upon which the meritocracy is founded, right, which is largely civil rights, second wave feminism, and then gay rights, is opening up, right? We don't want just this really tiny, small world in which, you know, everyone at Groton's grandmother knew the grandfather or the uncle. It was this very closed-off world. We want to open it up. And instead, what we've seen is that over a period of time, that world remains fairly closed. And that is part of what the failure that I'm identifying is, which is that we say in the meritocracy, you know, it is a vision of the American dream in which social mobility is the core value we have. People can come from anywhere. You can come from a farm on Kansas and end up at Harvard Law. You could be, you know, in a housing project in the South Bronx and go to Goldman Sachs. But actually, when you look at the data, we are undergoing a process of declining social mobility. It's harder and harder to start at the bottom and work your way to the top. And actually, what we're getting more towards is something like an upper class that's reproducing itself, which is precisely the kind of dysfunction that we wanted to avoid.
I wonder whether the flip side of meritocracy, which is that if you don't make it, and if you are not, quote unquote, a hard worker or have the kind of grit, you know, to make it in some of these more striving schools, then it's your fault because you didn't work hard enough.
Yeah, that is, I think, one of the nasty side effects of this social model we have. I mean, I should say that the idea of the meritocracy is a very self-justifying one, partly because defining what merit means is actually so difficult. Because if we all take a step back and say, well, should people with the most merit have the most important jobs? I think we all say, well, sure, that's an intuitive statement. But then you zoom in, you think, well, what does merit mean? It's actually a pretty complicated thing to try to define. Is it brains? Is it hard work? What does hard work mean? What are the different qualities that we want in people in different positions, some of which of those positions require different faculties and different qualities? And also, what does it mean to say that someone who doesn't make the cut at the very top, what kind of life are we okay to relegate them to? I mean, there was a moment in the middle of the century, particularly a vision of, say, Walter Reuther, who is the head of the United Auto Workers, in which the idea was, if you were an American and you were willing to work, you could have a relatively comfortable middle class life. You could own your own home. You could make a wage that would allow you to send your kids to school. That idea of everyone who's willing to work should have purchase in the great project of American affluence, that has been completely displaced by this more competitive model that we have now.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking with Christopher Hayes, author of a new book called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. And he's the host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. He's also editor-at-large of The Nation. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Craft Spoken Here, a celebration of the museum's collection of American, European, and Asian craft. Craft Spoken Here highlights Philadelphia's craft tradition and is designed to connect you with the crafting community through the Craft Lab, a space within the exhibition dedicated to demonstrating and exploring craft techniques. On view through August 12th. Details at philamuseum.org.
Well, some days you wake up.
Lydia Loveless plays country songs with a punk rock snarl, and she's not worried about any genre police who might cry foul.
You know, people who listen to music are just people, like anyone else. I don't think they're so boxed in as a lot of people think, so I hope that I can just write whatever comes out of me and people will appreciate it.
Lydia Loveless is live in our studio this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Gymnast Dominique Mocianu was the youngest member of the U.S. 1996 Olympic women's dream team, but that path to glory was often filled with physical and emotional pain, and that's a story she's been waiting to tell.
The time has come where I felt my story was necessary to share, and it took me 7 years to get it all out.
Gymnastic legend Dominique Mocianu on her new book, Off Balance. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Chris Hayes, who's at the studios of MSNBC, author of a new book called Twilight of the Elites. And we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Chris, if you can just expand on this, and in your book you call this the iron law of meritocracy. You reference this, but I want you to flesh it out for us.
Well, I think a good way of understanding is to go back to the example of my high school, right? So the idea of the high school is you got a setup where you really do have a equality of opportunity. Everyone takes the same test, and then we'll tolerate vast inequality of outcomes because, you know, some people are much better at testing, much smarter, much harder working than others. And the point I make in the book is that if you proceed under the presumption that you can neatly separate equality of opportunity, which is, you know, does everybody get a chance to get into the elite, and inequality of outcome, which is that the fact that we have a society with vast disparities in wealth, if you think you can neatly separate the two, what you find over time is that you can't, which is that vast disparities in wealth, inequality of outcome, are going to come to corrupt and disrupt all the ways that you would provide equality of opportunity. And we see this, you know, just basic intuitions about the way our society works. I mean, we have people who make, you know, billions of dollars, right? We understand intuitively that their kids are going to have all kinds of advantages and opportunities, whether it's the fact that they're father can donate a science library to a university and magically get his or her kid in, hire tutors, connections for internships, all of these ways of preserving privilege that are fundamentally anathema to the system that we want, right? The system we want where everyone's on a level playing field. And yet what we find is if you tolerate these vast, vast inequalities of outcome, vast inequalities of wealth and income, those are going to override whatever you're doing on the opportunity side to kind of create this equality of opportunity.
But it sounds like that this group that you're describing that have used the system to advance themselves, in a sense, are pulling up the ladder and creating their own kind of walled elite community.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the process that we've been undergoing. I mean, I start the book in looking at some of the institutional failures of the last decade and also looking at the mood of betrayal and alienation that I think suffuses our politics across the ideological spectrum, left and right. And I think it's partly a product of people's deep intuition that there is increasingly a group at the top, and there's different definitions of who those folks are.
Yes.
That are playing by a different set of rules. So we have a society in which the game is not the same for everyone. The rules are not fair and square. That there's a different set for those at the top than those in the middle at the bottom. And that does a fundamental violence to our conception of what the social contract should be, of what our idea is about what it is to be American. That we have this certain basic equality under the law in terms of our ability to vote and affect the political system. The less that is the case, the more that we have something that looks more and more like oligarchy, more and more with a small amount of people with a lot of power, the more people, I think, feel that there's something fundamentally wrong and corrupt about how the society is developing.
I'm not standing in for David Brooks here, but let me quote something he says. He says, today's elite lacks the self-conscious leadership ethos that the racist, sexist, and anti-Semitic old boys network did possess. The best of the WASP elites had a stewardship mentality, that they were temporary caretakers of institutions that would span generations. The idea is that if you belong to this elite club, you would, in a sense, you know, take care of it rather than use it for your own personal,
benefit.
Betterment or benefit, yes.
So I think David Brooks his nostalgia is somewhat misplaced. And the sentence there, the modifier that's doing a lot of work in that sentence is the best of the WASP elite. I mean,
yes.
The best of the current elite probably have a good ethos of stewardship as well. That's not really the issue. But that said, there is a core area where I think he and I agree in this, which is that I have a line in the book where I say we are cursed with an overclass convinced they are scrappy underdogs. Mm. And one of the pathologies of meritocratic formation is the fact that because you're constantly experiencing competition as the main way of living, and because you constantly see ladders of the rung above you, you don't think of yourself as privileged. You think of yourself always as relatively less privileged than the people that you're competing against or the people above you. So if you are, you know, someone who came from a relatively affluent family and went to very good schools and you get into Harvard University, you think you worked really hard and it was really hard and the application process was really hard and you stayed up late at night and you had to work your butt off to get in. You don't think, wow, I was really lucky to get all these to have all access to these resources. And so one of the perverse things that the meritocracy does and how it forms people that end up with a lot of power is it encourages them, it almost forces them to write a story about themselves, about their own success, that is a story of overcoming. Because everybody who makes it through thinks of themselves not as inheriting the place that they have. They think of themselves as having overcome. They think of themselves as having to go through this process of competition. And that creates a mentality, and we see it, you know, when it gets funneled from, you know, Princeton or Harvard into Wall Street, where, you know, absurd numbers of graduates of both those schools are going right into finance, where that cashes out in this kind of ceaseless competitive desire to make money, because that money signals it's used as a kind of token, a stand-in for your value.
And also connects that world to the world of politics as well, or to the world of Washington, D.C. Do you think we're moving closer to an oligarchy?
I think there's a tremendous number of extremely worrying trends about the ways in which public and private power have consolidated over the last 30, 40 years. And I think that one of the things that's interesting, if you go back to the late 19th century, around the time of the progressive movement and the populists and Teddy Roosevelt and trusts, when trusts were a huge political issue in American life. What's really interesting to go back and read the literature around trusts and the argument against trusts, right, at the time that you had, say, Standard Oil, which controlled, you know, I don't know, 90% of all the oil in the country. The arguments against the trusts weren't an economic one. They weren't that they're jacking up prices, they're distorting the market. The argument against trusts was fundamentally a political argument. The argument was that when you have power concentrated like this, it cannot but help skew the political system in ways that are offensive to our democratic commitments. And I think what's really important to think about in our current context is that there are lots of economic consequences of the kind of concentration of wealth that we have right now. And we saw it in the Great Recession, the financial crisis. We're seeing it now in the ways in which corporate profits and productivity have become totally detached from wages or employment. But the more profound challenge of this kind of concentration of wealth and income is what it does to the political system, is that it fundamentally makes it impossible to deliver on our central foundational vision of civic equality, of every person engaged in the collective enterprise of self-governance stands before the law and stands before his or her fellow citizens as an equal. And we see that now as we watch this campaign play out, that there, you know, some are much, much more equal than others.
Is that why the income divide, and it's not just between the rich and poor, but from the very rich and everyone else, is that why it's so that is so troublesome?
Yeah, because I think I think it's troublesome because we have a, you know, from the standpoint of principles, what my principles are as a liberal and as somebody who is proud to come from the tradition of the American left. That it's offensive to my conception of civic equality and what I think the best of the American project stands for. But I also think in practical terms, it's incredibly unstable. And this is one of the arguments I make in the book. And it's interesting because I think this argument is now getting made in a lot of different places. Joseph Stiglitz makes it in his book quite a bit. Jimmy Galbraith has a book out called Inequality and Instability. And the argument that I make in the book about inequality isn't really a moral argument about why inequality is bad for people at the bottom of the social pyramid, which I think is an argument that has been quite well honed mm-hmm. and crafted and made on the left. Mm-hmm. It's an argument about how inequality makes those at the top worse. It actually makes them worse decision makers, worse leaders, it makes them less capable of dispatching the duties that we would want them to undertake in a responsible and enlightened manner, because they are disconnected, because they are cut off, because they are formed in a process that makes them think of things like monetary reward as opposed to public costs.
And that's Chris Hayes. We are talking about his new book. It's called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. He's editor-at-large of The Nation. He's also the host of a relatively new show on MSNBC called Up with Chris Hayes. You can see it Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10. Joining us from the studios of MSNBC and talking about some of the fascinating, interesting, challenging ideas in his new book. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before we get to our callers, though, do you see connections between the Tea Party, such as it is, and Occupy?
I do, and I largely at the level of the visceral sensation that people have of the experience of what I call in the book the fail decade. That is the cascade of institutional failure, crisis, and corruption that really characterized the first decade of the 21st century. The feeling that people have in the Tea Party and in Occupy Wall Street and even disaffected moderates, people who consider themselves centrists who think that, you know, the system's broken or corrupt, is this idea that the game is rigged. I've heard that exact phrase, the game is rigged, from Occupy folks. I've heard it from Tea Party folks. And the idea is that there is, again, there's a group at the top that is essentially engaged in something that's fundamentally deceitful and self-dealing, and have access to power that allows them to manipulate the system in their favor in a way that ordinary folks who are outside that small circle don't. And that's a really toxic perception, and it's a toxic reality for people to have in a democracy, because the entire foundational premise of democracy is that we all get to say, that we all have power and we all have leverage and we all have influence collectively in what the rules are going to be and what our government is going to do and what our society is going to look like. And I think that there's this very common thread of a sense of betrayal and frustration and skepticism and distrust. There's really pervasive distrust in the society directed at institutions and the elites that run them.
Let me get some callers in. We have Anthony from Kensington joining us on Radio Times. Anthony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I wonder, he's not quite putting it in these terms, that if another way of framing this perhaps is that what you're talking about is class and how class works. That it's not surprising, I don't think, that an elite class, whether it's at least partially meritocratic or not, that an elite class acts in its own interests. That's pretty much all elite classes on the whole have ever done. Now, one of the tools that the working and middle classes have to keep the elite class from doing damage to them is politics. And from the New Deal era to the early 1980s, the middle and working classes were more or less able to do that. Now, why that has changed is pretty complicated, I think. But again, that what Mr. Hedges seems to be saying is that he's surprised by the way that elites, because they're at least in part meritocratic, work.
Okay.
I would say that's the way elite classes work. It's the only way they've ever worked.
Well, I hear you, and it's Chris Hayes, just so you know. There's a Chris Hedges who's somebody else. But nonetheless, Anthony, it's a good point, but let me give Chris Hayes a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Yeah, I largely agree with Anthony. I think this is when I call it an iron law of meritocracy, and I talk about elite theorists through the ages, including one, Robert Michels, who I cite in the book, who was writing about elites in 1915 and 16. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. The book largely is a look at class, and I'm not surprised that this kind of game rigging happens. The reason that I think it's important to point out, though, is that our whole American story that we tell ourselves about American society in the wake of the 1960s and 70s, in the wake of constructing this meritocracy, is that this is fundamentally a process that does manage to select out the people that are most deserving, that does manage to empower them, that it isn't rigged and closed off and corrupt in the ways that the bad old days of the best and the brightest were. And so in exposing the continuity in some ways between the way this our current elites function very similarly to previous incarnations is exposing the reality that I think undercuts a myth that we all, large portions of American society, right, left, Democrat, Republican, partake in, which is the idea that this is the system we have now is different and distinct and more fair.
Well, as Anthony was talking, I scribbled down FDR and Kennedy, or Ted Kennedy in specific, and these, of course, were elite families, powerful upper-class families, and you think about what FDR did in terms of dealing with the Depression. So I think making blanket statements about, you know, the upper class or any class is always can always be problematic.
Yeah, I mean, look, individuals are individuals, right? and individuals are not completely determined by their background in whatever that background is, their class origin or their race, their gender, all of these things. But there is such a thing as a culture of elites, and that's just the nature of human beings. People that have very tight social networks start to create norms they all share, and that norms affects their behavior in certain ways. And I think that's in large part what the topic of the book is about, is looking at the norms that we currently have, that we've currently constructed, and how they've become perverse in many consequences and destructive.
Can meritocracy be reformed?
You know, I don't.
No.
You know, I think I have some ambivalence in my own soul on this, and people who've reviewed the book have pointed that. I don't think it can, because I think there's something baked into the cake. And to go back to Anthony's point, you know, Anthony's point is, look, you know, if you have a class of elites, they're always going to be self-dealing, and I think what we need to do is go back to, or not even go back to forge a new vision of the social model that takes much more seriously our basic commitments to equality. And that doesn't mean that we have, you know, a complete equality of outcome and level playing field and a maximum income and a, you know, some system of you know, strictly communitarian or communist apportionment of resources. It does mean, though, that we can have a society that is far more equal than the one we have, and a society that combines some of the best attributes of the society in the period during the years Anthony was talking about, the 1930s to roughly the late 1970s, and the best attributes of the society we've had since then, which, let's not forget, we've made remarkable strides. I mean, in terms of women's workforce participation and the women's enrollment in things like medical school and colleges, and women's penetration of the upper echelons of the American elite, Black and Latino enrollment in you know, universities, in gay and lesbian integration into the, you know, the basic rituals and laws of American life. In all of these places, we've made tremendous strides that we do not want to jettison. What we want to do is forge a vision for an America that combines the vision of a broadly shared affluence that was the guidepost for America from the 1930s and 1980s with the tremendous social progress we've made in liberation and equality along lines of gender and race and sexual orientation.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Also get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Chris Hayes about his new book called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Again, he's editor-at-large of The Nation and host of MSNBC's Up with Chris Hayes. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The University of Delaware's MBA program offered at the Alfred Lerner College of Business and Economics supports WHYY, now accepting applications for the fall semester. The UD MBA is AACSB accredited and designed for flexibility with full and part-time options and evening classes held in Newark and Wilmington. Scholarships are available for qualified candidates as well as other benefits for applicants with GMAT scores over 600. UDGradBiz.com or 302-831-1200.
The new HBO documentary About Face features supermodels of the past, reflecting on their careers and on aging. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Beverly Johnson, the first African-American woman to be on the cover of Vogue, and Carol Alt, who's been on over 500 covers, and director Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who's photographed everyone from Barbara Bush to porn stars. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
On the next Voices in the Family, we dip into our archives to bring you conversations with two local psychologists who've published new books this year. Tamar Chansky is one of the nation's leading experts on anxiety disorder, and Scott Browning is a noted authority on stepfamily therapy. Voices in the Family, today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I think most people believe that the U.S. is in some degree of trouble with a dysfunctional political system, a growing economic divide, and institutional failures from Wall Street to Happy Valley. Chris Hayes says that the system of meritocracy is partially to blame, designed to open up opportunities to a new kind of leadership. He contends in his new book it's created a new kind of elitism, and the book is called Twilight of the Elites, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So let me get you to be concrete and even practical. When you talk about creating a country of more broadly shared affluence, are we talking about looking at the tax code, looking at our education system? Is that one of the keys you think that would open up more opportunity?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the first obvious step from a, if you're talking about practical policy measures, is reducing inequality. Now, there's a whole bunch of other conversations I had, and I've actually had some really interesting exchanges with conservatives about what America after meritocracy would look like, what kinds of engines of social mobility. But I think the first step you have to confront is the vast inequality of outcomes we have right now are a roadblock to the kind of social mobility that I think we all want. I mean, I think conservatives and liberals both believe in this idea that you should be able to rise as far as your, you know, talent and wits will take you. It's a very old American idea. So the first thing I think, and this, you know, this will sound like, oh, this is a warmed over, you know, classic liberalism. But, you know, we should raise taxes at the top. We should have a much more progressive system of taxation. We should do things like raise the minimum wage, which is basically the lowest rate it's been since 1960, if you adjust for inflation in terms of what its actual purchasing power is. Things like, say, public provision of public goods, for instance, university systems at the state level. I mean, look at the university, say, the California State University system, which is an amazing set of institutions and was a tremendous and has been a tremendous engine of social mobility. What are we seeing happen from state to state to these places? We are seeing their budgets being cut, and we are seeing tuitions being raised. We are seeing the competitiveness increase because it's harder and harder for people to find affordable higher education. That's exactly the opposite of what we should be doing if we want to increase social mobility and reduce inequality. So I think there's stuff we can do in the tax code. There's stuff we can do with in terms of retirement security. There's stuff we can do in terms of the minimum wage. The basic theme in all of this, though, is that it's not – if you have a political system that is committed to reducing inequality, you can do it. I mean, it's not a policy problem. It's doable. It's a political problem of whether you can dislodge the political – entrenched political power of people at the top who are quite hostile to any kind of incursions on their own wealth and power.
And the question is whether we have a political system that wants to rebalance income and equality, and whether the very wealthy have too much power to control the system.
That's right. I mean, that is the existential question for the democracy right now, I think. And, you know, you see different visions on marginal tax rates, for instance, laid out by both parties. And, you know, marginal tax rates can sound like the most dry, boring, arcane area
almost
of,
as bad as LIBOR, right?
Yeah. Although, no, LIBOR is fascinating.
No, it is fascinating. I agree.
But yes, from a distance, it can sound arcane or dry. But really, it comes down to a very fundamental and existential question, right? Which is, we know, if we look comparatively and throughout history, that one of the things that happens in a society or government that is sliding towards dysfunction and a process of de-development is that the elites manage to extricate themselves from the rules that bind everyone else together. And when you look at places that we considered, you know, developing world, we talk about corruption, we talk about oligarchs, that's what characterizes those societies, right? That there's a sense in which if you're at the upper echelons, for instance, of the military in Pakistan, you're not going to be subjected to the same rules as a shopkeeper in Lahore, right? That's precisely what defines what, you know, what folks, where nations lie on this development index that we conceive of for ourselves. And I think that's the big question when you get to something as arcane as marginal tax rates is actually a question about whether the system right now, the democracy we have, is capable of holding elites to account so that they do have to play by the same rules as everybody else. Because if they don't, then we're in very, very serious trouble.
Let me get John from Mount Airy to join our conversation. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
I have a couple of things. One, I think secretly a lot of Americans really want a super class system. I think you look at the political dynasties we get, the Bushes, the Kennedys, the Roosevelts, etc., that there's an underlying love for some type of class system like England. Secondly, I'm curious about the role you think legacy has played in the death of the meritocracy. Back when affirmative action was a big controversy, Bill Bradley said on the floor of the Senate, if we are truly against race-based things, the first thing we have to do is end affirmative action through legacy. That was the greatest affirmative action program in the history of the country. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering the role you see legacy playing in the end of the meritocracy. And I'll take my answer off the air.
John, two good questions. Thanks for the call. Should we take the legacy one first? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. So legacy is a perfect example of the ways in which the system that we call the meritocracy isn't very meritocratic at all, and yet we tolerate it. I mean, there's no, you know, affirmative action is remarkably controversial and in some ways has been ratcheted back. I mean, not in some ways. I mean, both through court rulings and actual policy, we have seen less and less of a commitment to affirmative action, something that I think has been a huge mistake and had hugely deleterious consequences. At the same time, there is no mass mobilization against legacies. There's a great book actually about this entire topic called Price of Admission, which is about the way college admissions actually work, particularly at elite schools. And it's not just legacies. There's all sorts of ways in which people with power and money rig the system in their favor. I mean, we found out that there was a huge scandal in Illinois in which state legislators were able essentially to pass out scholarships to the flagship state university. So the system of elite college admissions, I think, is a system that is doesn't even abide by its own our own basic meritocratic conception. So I think that's a key thing to point out.
And I think his other point is that we perhaps secretly yearn for a class system like England's.
Yeah, I think there is a strain in both America, and I think actually a strain that's just a universal part of human experience. The process of politics is ugly and difficult. The process and the reality, the day-to-day reality of self-governance, is a pain. I mean, it's often unpleasant. It's a lot of work. I mean, we forget because we've become so normalized to outsourcing things because our democracy is representative and also very – and that representation is increasingly attenuated. We're increasingly remote and distant from it. We forget what a radical idea self-governance is. I mean, self-governance says that we all decide together, and that all means the people that you ride the bus with to work in the morning, and then the people who all work on your floor, some of which who drive you crazy, right? And
sure
the people
remain nameless, yes, but go
ahead.
Yeah,
exactly. And everybody, you know, standing next to you at the gym or picking up their kids at the daycare center at night, all of those people, all of us together, we're all making decisions together. And that is a really hard ideal to live up to. And I think it's a timeless truth about democracy is that there is a slide towards oligarchy. There's a slide away from democracy partly because it requires so much of us. It's like when you decide to take the elevator instead of the stairs. We get accustomed to taking these shortcuts, and I think desiring some kind of aristocratic class that could make the decisions for us is part of that same impulse. There's this impulse to want other people to do it because it's so much work. And the process of a dynamic and functioning democracy is this constant battle against that sort of slide towards stasis.
And there's also that fantasy of you know, being the 1% or being part of the aristocracy.
Yeah, and that's hugely – I mean, the meritocracy functions, I think, in people's minds the same way the lottery does. I mean, you see the way that – when there's a huge lottery payoff, you know, people are talking about it at the coffee shop or work, and people are all – because everybody can be animated by the tangibility of the dream of winning. And meritocracy holds out the same thing. I mean, when we hear the stories, I mean, we see the President of the United States and we think, you know, one day, whatever station I'm in right now, no matter how hard my life might be as a single mother trying to raise a son on, you know, essentially minimum wage – that there's, we hold out the hope that our kids can end up in that small winner circle, that they can essentially win the American lottery.
Sure.
And the system has tremendous appeal for that reason.
Let me get, looks like Sam, John, thanks for the call. We have Sam now from Center City, Philadelphia. Sam, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments,
okay.
One for the guest and one for the host.
Okay.
The first one for the guest. Thank you very much. I think the last point that you hit on was the most important. I'm going to call it the responsibility of the citizenry. And if pundits really are helping shape what Americans think about the role they play in our elected government, I think pundits really do need to do more about talking about the role of the responsibility of the citizenry and the fact that that role really begins once you've cast your vote and walked out of the voting booth. The roll doesn't stop there.
Okay.
And the comment for the host, love your show, long-time listener, you got to take more calls in an hour. Thank you.
Well, we took your call, Sam, and we've been taking calls for the last half hour. But let me go. Do you think of yourself as a pundit, Chris Hayes? Are you a pundit now?
I would hope that when all is done and I am put into the cold earth, that won't be what is on my gravestone.
Is that right? You don't want that?
I mean, look, the problem with pundit and the idea of punditry is there's a certain model of people opining about things they don't know anything about.
Yes, there's a lot of that.
And that's one thing that we one thing we really try to avoid as much as possible on the show. I mean, one of the things we really try to do in programming the show and booking the show and thinking about how we're going to manage these conversations is to make sure that people are coming at the issues with either some stake in it. That is, you know, we had a conversation about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, formerly called food stamps. We had someone who was on food stamps, you know, at the table. They have a stake in it. Or someone who has expertise or experience that is relevant, so that we're creating conversations that aren't just this kind of airy, removed opining that I think can sometimes be really dominant in our political culture and that people find frustrating and angering, and I think justifiably so.
Just to get a little off topic here, you're talking about your show on MSNBC. Do you watch your show and watch yourself on TV?
No. No. I mean, I find my traits and tics like pretty tough to watch. So I don't sometimes I'll watch a segment or two if there was something we spent a lot of time working on or a conversation that happened and I was so immersed in it I was sort of unclear whether you know, it was good television. But for the most part I don't.
And have you had those nightmares, I think, that hosts have, which is that you dream that you prepared for the wrong interview or you couldn't find the office
or you
read the wrong book and the wrong guest showed up?
Yes. Yeah. I've had a whole had all of the cliched
exactly.
host anxiety dreams.
Right. Forgot to get dressed that morning, that kind of thing.
Yes. That one occurs a lot. Or the other one that I always have is that, you know, what if – I think I have the idle sort of – anxiety-ridden daydream rather than actual like night dream of like, you know, the car breaks down or something and I have to like run the last 3 miles to get to.
There you go. Well, just to keep Sam happy, let me get one more caller in.
Sure.
Looks like we just lost that particular person. Let's go to Bob, actually, Bob from Fleetwood. And go ahead, Bob, you're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
My issue had to do with college financial aid. It seems that the wealthy people have figured a way to sort of game the system, that programs that were initially designed to give financial aid to the economically disadvantaged and minorities have been gamed by the wealthy people to for their own benefit. And as a consequence, minorities, these are people particularly from India, from Africa, from South America, who qualify as being minorities, often get preferential treatment in terms of financial aid. And I know a number of people who have came from wealthy families and then instead of the money going to people who actually are in need and who have maybe some merit and opportunity to do well, are sort of denied.
Well, let me take your call only because we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye to Chris Hayes. But Chris, go ahead.
Real quick, I think Bob puts his finger on something important, but I think he's conflating two different things. So one of the things that we've seen at elite schools recently is that their diversity numbers have been boosted by taking a lot of students from abroad, from the Middle East, for instance, and other places around the world in which they can then, and obviously that increases the racial diversity and the ethnic diversity, the religious diversity of a campus, and I think that's very good. But it's a very different thing to say, well, we have, the son of a Qatari prince who is now in our school. That's very different than we have a Dominican kid from, the East Bronx in terms of what that means about the school as an engine of social mobility. And I do think there's a degree to which, in terms of what diversity looks like on these elite campuses, those two things are being conflated and one's being used to mask the absence of the other.
Bob, thanks for the call. And Chris Hayes, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. And again, he's editor-at-large of The Nation, host of MSNBC's Up with Chris Hayes, which airs Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 until 10. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. My thanks to Tracy Matisak for filling in last week. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.